Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. From 438 miles above, the wisps of green are almost moss-like. Maybe, with a quick glance, they could be mistaken for some badly kept fairways. They stretch across the dark background, concentrating on two areas, but casting a green hue. They're framed on three sides by white cotton balls, puffs of clouds floating over the central Florida landscape. That's part of the picture that developed this week, courtesy of NASA's Landsat 8 satellite. The pair of photos shows the massive algae bloom in Lake Okeechobee, the goo, the gunk that continues to foul up the waterways and the Treasure Coast down to Palm Beach County. Now, you can see these photos on our Twitter feed right now, at WLRN, or on our Facebook page. Governor Rick Scott wants the federal government to declare a state of emergency. He argues that because the feds manage Lake Okeechobee and the protective Hoover Dike on its southern rim, it's the federal government's responsibility. This week, the governor also pledged he would ask state lawmakers to spend more money next year for communities near the algae blooms to replace septic tanks with sewer systems. Tourists may be scared away, but the politicians are still coming. Republican Senator Marco Rubio visited Stewart a week ago.
Well, a number of things that can happen immediately. Number one is I hope we can convince the court, perhaps even stop flows for a short period of time to allow water through here to kind of flush itself out. Second is get an emergency declaration from the president so that we can have some more assistance available to local business owners and the local community.
Florida State Senate President Republican Joe Negron also saw the algae firsthand.
To me, it's similar to what happened with the Deep Horizon spill, and I was serving in the Senate then, and a group of us went to Northwest Florida right at that time to see the devastation firsthand, and I see a lot of similarities.
So what can the state do? What can the feds do? Are you watching this environmental disaster engulf some of our beaches and rivers? Are you satisfied that it's getting the response it deserves? Let us know here as we get started on the Florida Roundup this week, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Find us on social media as well, at WLRN or on Facebook. Our guests this week include Jill Roberts with our sister station in Fort Pierce, WQCS. Craig Pittman has watched Florida environment and reported on it for years with the Tampa Bay Times. And in Tallahassee, Gary Fineout with the Associated Press and Mary Ellen Kloss with our partner, the Miami Herald. Jill, let's start with Fort Pierce. You're in the thick of it. Is it any better or worse this week?
Well, I was just down by the river yesterday, and it wasn't smelling as bad, and we could breathe a little bit more freely. I guess you could say it's getting a little bit better, but as you know, as it maybe clears out the algae, as it dies, it's just going to go to the bottom, and it's still going to be in the ecosystem.
So, Craig, what is this stuff?
Well, it's a toxic blue-green algae. It started in Lake Okeechobee, and it was first detected there in May. And because the Corps of Engineers was pumping water out of the lake to try and lower it prior to hurricane season, they pumped the algae out to the two coasts as well. So it flowed out to the Caloosahatchee River on the west, and it flowed into the St. Lucie River on the east and took the algae with it. And so then the algae began showing up there along the coast in Stewart, and there was enough, usually salt water would be enough to kill it, but there was enough fresh water coming from the lake with those pulses that the Corps of Engineers was turning loose that it has kept it going, and it's been going and going and going and just multiplying and making things worse.
Some of this algae bloom is normal for this time of year, the hot temperature, the high water temperatures, but Craig, is this algae bloom that we're seeing this year, this strain of algae, any different than what we normally see? The volume clearly is different, but is the algae itself
different.
Any different?
From what I've been told, no, it is the same one that was such a plague on the land in 2005 when there was a similar algae bloom situation going on, and in fact there were people who were unaware of the danger of it and went out swimming and got staph infections and other things from it. So that should tell you how long this kind of problem's been going on also.
Gary, the problem has been going on for a good long time. The Governor Scott, has declared a state of emergency in four counties. He did that about 10 days or so ago. Now he wants a federal declaration. Why? What's the difference?
Well, the issue is if you get the declaration, then you can be eligible for some types of federal aid. Although, if there's a disaster declaration, there would have been more aid.
Gary, I'm going to interrupt you. I just cannot hear you quite too well from Tallahassee. We're going to get that fixed here. I want to go back, Jill, to you in Fort Pierce as we get the engineering fixed. Talk to us about what the response this week has been and how it has been any different, if at all, from a week ago as this algae bloom really began to take root.
Well, they have addressed it. Our local officials said they were just put out a press release. They were happy that the governor has asked for the federal declaration, which can only come if the governor asked for it. The Corps of Engineers has gone to pulse releases from the lake, which means rather than just a steady release, they kind of back it off, and then they increase it, back it up to more mimic the natural cycle. Should we get rain, you know, we certainly get runoff when we have rain, and then it stops till we get more rain. So they're doing reduced releases, and Florida Power and Light and some other places have agreed to hold some water north of the lake to keep it from going into the lake to begin with.
So let's talk about this here, because we're talking about massive amounts of water that had been taken out of Lake Okeechobee because the lake, which is the huge reservoir, of course, of fresh water from North Florida down into Central Florida, was close to historic high levels, Craig Pittman, as we entered the wet season. And the Army Corps of Engineers, responsible for the safety of the Hoover Dike and, of course, the lake levels, has reduced the fresh water flows out the sides by about 30% compared to what it was 2 weeks ago. Is that going to be enough?
Well, it's a start. But the folks I've talked to say what they really want is for them to stop releasing water out of there completely.
Is that even possible, though?
Well, from the Corps' perspective, no. They're really worried about any sort of heavy rain or a tropical storm formation coming over and overfilling that lake, and it's to the point where the dike can't hold it anymore, and then suddenly you're looking at a big disaster. This is the big reason why the governor is blaming the federal government for not fixing the dike and making it higher. He's saying that's the end solution here. A lot of the folks who live on the coast, though, they would prefer that the state take action to buy up or use eminent domain to condemn sugar properties south of the lake so that the water could then flow southward the way it used to naturally instead of going to the estuaries. Of course, the sugar industry is very opposed to that.
I'm going to bring in Eric Eichenberg, who's the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, who's very familiar with that Central Everglades plan, in a moment. But first, I want to go back to Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. Gary, to the state response here, again, back to this point that that Craig is talking about the governor of the state of Florida asking essentially for this federal declaration and putting this on the federal government. How much of that is politically viable? How much of it is environmentally accurate?
Well, I think the main thing here is that when it comes to the governor, he has had a history of blaming the federal government on a whole variety of issues. It is without a doubt that the feds have not come through with the amount of extra funding to repair the dike, with the amount of funding for Everglades restoration. But as Craig pointed, there are state solutions that have become very contentious. And we have a divide even among the Republicans who are in the legislature about whether or not to go ahead and try to get that sugar land. The incoming Senate President, Joe Negron, has said that he is willing to consider the issue, but I just don't know if there would be political will among the rest of them to do it.
We are talking about the blue-green algae bloom for the second week in a row here on the Florida Roundup as that algae bloom continues fouling up waterways in the Treasure Coast, moving south into Palm Beach County. Has it impacted your summer vacation in South Florida? Has it impacted perhaps folks that you were going to show off some of Florida's famed beaches to? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. This week we saw satellite photos of Lake Okeechobee where you could clearly see the algae bloom growing in this big bad lake in South Florida. Let's take a phone call here. Eric Eichenberg, as I mentioned, is the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, former chief of staff to Governor Charlie Crist, who was a key player in the state planned purchase of U.S. sugar land, which would have acted as storage areas. Eric, as Governor Scott essentially canceled that deal several months ago, is this a storage problem? Is this a water quality problem? How do you weigh both of those challenges? We'll try to get Eric on the line here as soon as we can. Craig, I want to put that question to you, Craig Pittman, if we still have you with the Tampa Bay Times.
Yes.
How do you balance that that water quality challenge versus the storage challenge?
Well, that's a big problem. And Lake Okeechobee, of course, has been they've known for years that Lake Okeechobee has been this sort of big pollution problem, that's where the nitrogen and phosphorus that's in the lake from years of abuse is in there. There's about a 3-foot layer in the bottom that contains all this stuff, and whenever there's a big storm that sweeps through, it stirs it all up all over again. Back in 2005-2006, one of the solutions that was being discussed was bringing in dredges to section off parts of the lake and dredge that muck out of there and move it out in order to try to clean up the lake water. But that was right before the recession hit, and I don't think the funding ever materialized for that sort of mammoth undertaking. So
yeah,
as long as the lake continues to be used the way it's used, it's going to continue to be a source for these algae blooms that then plague and disrupt the tourist businesses on both of the coasts.
So as this debate continues, let's move this ball forward. Gary Fineout this week, Governor Scott, said he's going to propose in the next legislative session more money that he thinks is going to help address some of the longer-term problem here, which is nitrogen and phosphorus in the water, to some degree caused by leaky seepage out of septic tanks around waterways. This isn't money to go toward water storage south of the lake. It's not money to go toward central Everglades restoration to get the water flowing south again. It's money for property owners and septic tanks. Is this the strategy that is going to find support among state lawmakers as opposed to water storage?
Well, I think that there is going to be a level of support for it, but you hit the nail on the head. The question is, how does it take care of the immediate problem? What you have, of course, is, as lots of things are in the political dynamic, you have a lot of finger-pointing going on. You have a lot of blame that's cast here and cast there, and the question is, what is the appropriate solution for everyone to rally around? I think that the issue of the septic tanks, just like Craig was talking about the problems in Lake O, the problems with septic tanks have been known for a while now. And in fact, in terms of the legislature has tried to address it a couple of times, and then there was a tremendous political backlash. It wasn't so many years ago that there was an effort in terms of aimed at improving water quality at springs, that there was this idea of mandatory septic tank inspections, and the idea that we would try to, you know, try to convince people that they needed to switch out their septic tanks and do things to at least fix them and keep them so that they were operating. The legislature, in the face of opposition, wound up repealing that requirement. So I think that, Senator Negron, when I talked to him this week, that was one of the things he said. Well, I can get behind Governor Scott's proposal on handing out grants to people to put in central sewer, but I don't want anything that's going to require mandatory inspections, and I don't want anything that's going to be, a mandate.
Tom, can I just make one quick point?
Craig Pittman, go ahead.
As Gary mentioned, the legislature passed a law a few years ago to try to improve the state's water quality by requiring private individuals to have inspections of their septic tanks. And obviously, if the septic tank wasn't working and was leaking, causing pollution, then they'd have to pay to fix it. Now, of course, and there was such political opposition, it was repealed. Now, of course, instead of private individuals paying to replace septic tanks, we're talking about the taxpayers themselves having to pay for replacing septic tanks for these folks. So that's the solution that the legislature and the governor are now reaching for, is instead of having the people who are doing the polluting pay for it, the taxpayers are going to pay for it.
Well, I mean, to some degree, the septic tanks are partial to blame here. So the homeowners that have the septic tanks that are in the property and have been in the property prior to the early 80s and some of the setback rules changing are part of the problem as much as big agriculture and other water quality
right.
issues.
They are
be,
part
correct?
Of the problem, but I'm just making the point that originally it was going to be up to them to pay to replace them. Now it's right. all of us taxpayers are going to have to pay for it.
Yeah. Eric Eichenberg, the CEO of Everglades Foundation, is this, have we now replaced the effort to buy land and to store water, which had been part of the 2000, the year 2000, comprehensive Everglade restoration project, with now septic tank efforts on the state level?
Well, I certainly hope not. And, you know, what has to stop is, first, the blame game has to stop. I've just spent the last couple of days up in Stewart where we saw firsthand what this toxic blue-green algae looks like and smells like. And I will tell you, it takes your breath away. And it's impacting not only the local environment, but also the local economy. And people up there want, they want this to stop. And the blame game doesn't help. And what I'm hopeful for is that everybody realizes that the plan is in place. It's before us. What we need is the political will to implement these projects that are going to significantly send water south. Because as we're talking this morning about the algae bloom to the north, we have another estuary that's in crisis. Florida Bay, some 60,000 acres of dead seagrass down in the Florida Keys because of a lack of fresh water flowing through the system.
So, Eric, have you heard any of that political will stated in the last 2 weeks as this algae bloom has grown along the Treasure Coast?
Well, I certainly have seen a lot of media coverage of folks showing up with a bank of cameras behind them inspecting the toxic algae. We're encouraged by Senator Negron, who represents Martin County, who will, as you've talked about, will be the next Senate president, and he is committed. He has publicly stated his commitment to solving this problem, identifying land south of Lake Okeechobee. The money is there based on Amendment 1, based on Legacy Florida this past session. We just need the effort now to come together and let's solve this problem. Tom, real quick, there's a headline in the Martin County Commission offices that shows the Stewart News from the 1930s lamenting about lake discharges. This is happening for too long. It's time to store, clean, and send water south so we can get this water down to the Florida Keys.
Eric Eichenberg is the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, joining us here on the Florida Roundup, talking about the algae bloom that can be seen from space now in Lake Okeechobee and along the Treasure Coast south into Palm Beach County. 800-743-WLRN. We'll get to your phone calls in a moment. 800-743-9576 on Twitter and on Facebook. I want to go back to the phones with Jill Roberts at WQCS in Fort Pierce, which is right in the heart of this area that has been struggling with the algae bloom. And Jill, as you hear Eric Eichenberg, the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, I know you spoke with him this week in person, and you hear him cite headlines from the 1930s. You've reported on previous algae blooms as well. This one clearly is different by sheer volume and sheer public attention. What do the residents want done? What do they want done this week? What do they want done next year and next decade? I don't know if Jill is still with us. I can't hear Jill right now. We'll try to get her back. Gary, let me ask you that same question. The state legislature has wrestled with this issue for decades. What is to be expected is going to be different in March of 2017 when they gavel another session in?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that you have a top legislator who's from that region will draw some more attention to it. But I think the situation is the political dynamic kind of remains somewhat unchanged. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the sugar industry has a tremendous amount of allies in the legislature, and they have usually been very successful in pushing plans, whether it's the Everglades or things related to it, that reflect their political position on this stuff. And I'm not sure you're going to see a dramatic change from that. Now, that doesn't mean that Senator Negron won't make it a top priority, but the issue has to do with whether or not he can get the House and the governor to go along.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone calls here. Let's go to line four. Fred is calling from Fort Lauderdale here on the Florida Roundup. Fred, welcome to the program. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Thank you. I wish that these politicians and everybody would stop haggling and do something. being an amateur, I don't know what is happening to the estuary leading out of the of Lake Okeechobee, but I would imagine any freshwater fish are dead. And if we had some boats and dumped half a ton of salt in those estuaries, would it kill the algae? And would we at least be getting somewhere rather than getting nowhere?
Fred, thanks for the phone call. Let me put that to Craig Pittman, an environmental reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. Craig, is a barges full of salt on the estuaries, is that a viable solution?
Well, it might kill the algae, but it also might kill a lot of other stuff, too. I mean, the whole thing with those estuaries is that they provide the proper balance of fresh and salt and brackish water for the fish and other creatures that live there. And if you go messing around with the balance of salt or any other thing in there, then you're liable to cause more harm than help.
This is a problem, obviously, that dates back to the 19th century in the ways that South Florida especially began to carve up and drain the Everglades. This is not a new challenge, certainly. Let's go to line two with Kathleen, who's calling from Lake Worth. Kathleen, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, your thoughts. Let's go to Kathleen on line two from Lake Worth. Kathleen, are you with us?
I am. My question is a quick one. Is Mother Nature supplying this toxic algae to us, along with this 3 feet of toxins that are at the bottom of the lake? Or is it continuous spraying of the produce and sugar with insecticides and pesticides that is causing this?
Great question, Kathleen. The source of this pollution, Craig Pittman, correct me if I'm wrong, is fed. The algae is naturally caused, but it is fed, and its growth is sped up by this nitrogen and phosphorus-rich water that flows into Lake Okeechobee. Is that correct?
Yes, and you have to bear in mind that there's suburban lawns up in Orlando that's feeding into that, so the fertilizer off those lawns. Farms that have animal waste and fertilizer, excess fertilizer that flows in there. For the longest time, the sugar companies were back pumping water off of their land into the lake, so that added to the mess. And the state, instead of cracking down and making things harder, making it harder to dump pollution in the lake, has gone the other direction. Water bill that the legislature passed and the governor signed into law not too long ago actually makes it where you don't need a permit to continue dumping pollution in the lake. Instead, you just agree to follow what's known as best management practices. So if as long as you're doing these certain things, they're going to assume you're not polluting, whether you are or not.
Mary Ellen Kloss with our partner, the Miami Herald in Tallahassee. Let me put that kind of political question to you, because we have seen laws proposed and laws passed and laws signed by this governor and past state legislatures that environmentalists will say have weakened water quality standards. But industry supporters will say those federal standards don't acknowledge some of the peculiarities of not only industry in Florida, but also some of the water. So what are some of those decision points that have kind of come to bear in what we're seeing this summer?
Well, it's interesting. If you were to put together a timeline of the last 20 years and look at when there was a point at which, it appeared there was a critical mass of understanding that we needed to set aside land to clean up water so that we could restore the natural flow of Lake Okeechobee and all the estuaries. And there are about five or six different times, and every single governor has embraced the Everglades, and they're going to be they've had their Everglades moment.
Right.
But if you also look, and every decision, for example, Eric Eichenberg refers to the 2000 Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. That happened 15 years ago. They had an elaborate system of projects and proposals put together for that. Well, as soon as the deadline started to get closer, and it appeared that it might be a little too onerous for the landowners and the sugar industry, the legislature passed a law to extend the deadline another 20 years. There is a history of this where we have an opportunity to buy U.S. sugar land. The price of sugar is very low, and the recession is about to happen. It's going to be more difficult for the state because of the recession to come up with the money, and then this price of sugar rebounds, and U.S. sugar puts pressure on the legislature to retract most of that offer, and so we buy only a fraction of the land that they say they need. There's examples of this throughout the last 20 years.
And are there any examples of it moving toward some kind of even small step solutions as opposed to the big comprehensive solution that the federal government and the state government forged 15 years ago, but looking for perhaps smaller steps that maybe could give folks along the Treasure Coast a little bit of optimism that maybe next summer won't be as bad?
Well, I think there has been a lot of progress, and I don't think that there are lots of progress, lots of projects underway. There are reservoirs, you know, that have been established. There is cleaning being done and improvements being made, and I think the farmers and landowners are also part of that solution. Mm-hmm. The problem is that to get to the core and to the heart of the answer, it's going to take sugar land. That's the question of whether there is the political will. And the other thing that is, you know, Florida is a state of not very many giant corporate interests, but sugar is one of them. And when you look at the political contributions, the amount of money that industry has put into the political parties is enormous. They have been one of the lasting sustainers of the Democratic Party. And when you look at the emergence of the Republican Party back in the 90s, when Jeb Bush was just coming into office and the Republicans were taking over the legislature, the numbers show that sugar gave a phenomenal amount of money to the Republicans in that decade, or in that couple, actually just a very short election cycle. So their money talks.
Money definitely does talk, and so do our listeners. Let's go to line 7. Harold in Davie is along with us with a question about the role of industry in this. Harold, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah. It's nice to speak to you. I was just wondering, in regards to the toxic algae obviously affecting the water and the sugar company's influence in keeping the water from being able to flow south just because they're utilizing it, isn't that going to have disastrous effects upon the sugar industry anyways? I mean, our ecosystem here in Florida obviously is a very delicate one. And, I mean, like, with our waterways being connected the way that they are and, you know, with the composition of, you know, just the dirt and everything, you know, being so porous, I mean, that water is going to eventually, like, seep back into the water table, is it not?
So the question is, this nitrogen phosphorus rich water that is helping feed this algae bloom going to wind up in the ecosystem and perhaps impacting sugar growers come December, January, and February when they start hitting their growing season? Craig Pittman, do you know?
I don't know. Sorry.
We'll have to leave that question for some of our other hydrologist and ecologist and agriculture experts, but a great question nonetheless, Harold. Thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Craig Pittman, watching the environment for the Tampa Bay Times with us. Thank you, Craig. Always great to have you. Jill Roberts earlier from WQCS in Fort Pierce. Thank you, Jill. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press, Marilyn Klaus with the Miami Herald. Stick with us. We got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Winning an election with no opponents. How about that? Weren't new political districts supposed to make politics more competitive in Florida? That's next as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. You did not miss Election Day, but about a dozen South Florida lawmakers already are assured they will be sent back to Tallahassee when the next legislative session begins in March. The districts they represent in 2017 may be different than the areas that sent them to the Capitol 2 years ago. It's because of a long legal battle over political boundaries. Statewide, 11 Senate districts, 29 House districts have no opposition. So where is the political competition in the Sunshine State? How will you feel if there's only one candidate on the ballot this November for your state house or Senate district? Did your district get redrawn? Has that affected the politics, or is it the same song, just a different year for you? Let us know here. Politics statewide up next here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Dan Sweeney joins us, political reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Dan, how many unopposed, quote-unquote, re-elections have already happened in South Florida?
Well, between the state representatives and the state senators, you have three state senators in South Florida that were unopposed and a dozen state representatives. So that's 15 out of 50 state legislators total that make up South Florida.
And were these newly drawn districts?
Well, in the case of the three state senators, yes. State House districts have been around for a few years, but the state Senate districts are all brand new. And so these people aren't really incumbents per se. In fact, no state senator is.
Right.
Because, you know,
the full legislature's up for re-election this year because of this redistricting. Everybody in the House, everybody in the Senate.
Right, which is unusual. Usually there's 40 state senators, and usually it's 21 year, 20 the next year.
Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. How has redistricting impacted how these state legislative races, as such, stack up at all?
Well, I think it is important to point out that redistricting did have a dramatic effect on the congressional delegation. I don't want to lose sight of that because
are the 27 individuals that we send to Washington. Absolutely.
Well, right, and we had competitive. I don't know how competitive the races will be, but every seat got contested for Congress. So then we turn our attention to the state Senate. Yes, there were some people who did not get challenged and did not oppose. Now, part of this was a bit of an interesting kind of moving back and forth at the very end of qualifying and people jumping from one seat into another seat and deciding they were going to run against that. And that jockeying goes on every cycle. I don't, you know, where somebody tries to figure out where they think they have the best advantage and they could possibly run. In terms of, I think what we're going to see, however, is we still have on the board, we have several competitive seats left with Democrats and Republicans. Now, it's only a handful, but it's a bit of a change from what we had before.
Mary Ellen Klaus, is it enough to put the balance of power in Tallahassee at stake in terms of the Republican supermajority that it has enjoyed in Tallahassee for the past several legislative sessions?
Well, I don't think we're going to have a shift of balance, a shift of power, but we will see that the Republicans hold. I do think the supermajority in the Senate is not going to repeat itself, and it will be eaten away. The Democrats will be able to gradually inch away at the majority in the House. It's going to take a long time, and part of the problem is that we have term limits and we have an enormous dependence on campaign finance, as I mentioned earlier. And when you have that, those two factors, people often don't want to challenge an incumbent. They just wait them out until their 8-year term is over. And it takes a lot of money to mount a campaign. And right now, the Republican Party in Florida is in pretty difficult shape, although they have an enormously a lot more money than the Democrats do. But the Democrats just simply do not have the kind of funds they need to challenge people in every single race. Now, one thing they did do that was, I think, a pretty big accomplishment is that they gave a competitor to they filed somebody to run in all the Democratic in all the Republican races. So it looks as though that there will be at least a nominal challenge. And that's the beginning.
I think you're referring to Miami-Dade, right?
Right.
In South Florida, they mounted a competitive, you know, not always super competitive, but they've got a Democrat running in all the races. And that's ground zero. Miami-Dade is ground zero for where the shifts are going to happen when they happen.
Let me bring in Michael Oslin with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times, Tallahassee Bureau, along with us from the capital city. Michael, some of this dates back to this redistricting Fair District Amendment, this lawsuit that had been fought for a couple of years to redraw congressional districts, as Gary Fineout mentioned, but also some of them, as well as state Senate districts. The point of that, has the goal of that redistricting effort been met? The goal of the lawsuit over the redistricting been met?
Well, I think the redistricting effort was, you know, had to do with getting rid of these districts that were drawn to specifically favor one party over another, often Republicans, given their, you know, majority here in the legislature. But I think it's worth pointing out that some of these folks who were automatically elected without a challenger were in seats that weren't going to go to another party. You look at people like Lauren Book down in Broward County. That's a very Democratic-leaning seat.
Could be a freshman.
Not going to win that.
And a freshman first-time lawmaker as well.
Right. And you see that in North Florida as well, you know, people, Aaron Bean and Rob Bradley, who are both, you know, sitting Republican senators who weren't going to see strong competition from Democrats anyway. So there is competition in some of these closer districts, even though we do have a lot of people coming to Tallahassee without having to appear on a ballot.
Marilyn Kloss, talk to us about the competition that seems to be forming. You see sprouts of it, political competition between the parties in some of these districts in South Florida. Where do you anticipate it to be hot? And what are those issues, if any, that are going to be atypical this election cycle in those areas?
Well, for example, we have the most competitive race is likely to be between Miguel Diaz de la Portilla and Jose Javier Rodriguez. He is Jose is a Democrat state representative. Miguel is an incumbent state senator. Miguel's district was dramatically changed to include a much larger share of Democrats, and that makes it very competitive for both of those. And it's really hard to tell which direction that will go. It was interesting because you knew this was coming, by the way. Senator Diaz de la Portilla managed his last session. He moved and moderated on quite a few issues, including blocking some of the gun legislation that you've talked about. So there's that district. And then another district that is going to see a lot of competition is District 40. That is the one where Senator Dwight Bullard is the incumbent, and that district was dramatically rewritten as well. While it's a Democrat majority seat, it's evenly divided. It's evenly divided between independents, Democrats, and Republicans. And so Bullard faces two opponents, former State Representative Anna Rivas-Logan and a newcomer, Andrew Korge. And then whoever becomes the nominee from that group will then face State Representative Frank Artiles. And so that is going to be a big race to watch as well. And I also think that is one of those that is going to be hard to predict because, first of all, Artiles has a lot of money. Whether the Democrats will be able to even match that is unlikely. But they do have the incumbent, and they have a slight edge in voter registration.
Dan Sweeney with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. All of this jockeying for position. First simple question, do candidates have to live in the districts they represent in Florida?
Yes. In the state legislature, you do have to live in that district. And that's been a problem for a couple of people throughout South Florida. But, you know, this happens every year where people start running in a district they don't actually live in, and then they wind up living there in some little place by the time they're actually elected. So that'd be nothing new if somebody who doesn't actually live in the district currently winds up representing that district.
And how is this jockeying for position, these redrawing of the political boundaries, changing political allies, or frankly some of the issues that voters could focus in on? Dan, I want to put that question to you, and given the example that Marilyn Kloss just gave in terms of Senator De La Portilla and some of the more moderate positions one would argue that he took on expanding gun legislation, those legislative expansion proposals died in his committee in the Florida Senate during this last legislative session. And that's been pointed to, obviously, as a spot where a Republican had kind of moderated some of the gun expansion issues. Where other places, Dan, do you anticipate to see this?
Well, I would point out also that Diaz de la Portilla killed those gun bills in the session before that, too. So this is 2 years running where he killed those bills, or at least the ones that came up 2 years in a row. So, you know, it's something that he's done time again. He's been consistent on that, at least for the last couple of sessions. One thing that as far as the House races, one of the more competitive ones, the Senate are definitely going to be the ones to really look at. But in the House at 103, Manny Diaz is running against Yvette Gonzalez Petkovic. She's made a big issue out of education there. That's not really something that Manny Diaz has kind of come back on. He's the COO of a charter school, and she's, kind of raised the red flag about a lot of the money going to charter schools and sort of pushed for more traditional public education. So that's going to be a big debate, I think, in that district.
Michael Auslin, I want to hear from you on this point of issues. Obviously, the political jockeying in terms of which race to choose is over now that qualifying is over. Now it becomes staking out political positions. How do those redrawn lines on the political map articulate themselves in some of the issue debates that we should be listening to in the months ahead?
I think certainly in these more competitive districts, we're going to see Republicans and Democrats potentially going toward the middle. To bring up Mary Ellen's point about guns again, we saw that just the last week or so as Democrats have pushed for a special session dealing with restricting guns. Their attempt to create a special session failed, but in doing so, they put all of the most of the members of the legislature on the board voting yes or no for coming back to Tallahassee to deal with this issue. And so you see some people such as Senator Diaz de la Portilla not responding to that vote. It's a tough vote if you're someone like him who's a Republican in a pretty moderate district.
Describe that non-response. It was a matter of by the time it kind of got around to him, it didn't matter which way he would have voted. The special session would have lost.
Correct. Yeah, the special session, there were enough votes in the House of Representatives to kill a special session. But Senator Diaz de la Portilla and some others didn't vote, or maybe they voted alongside Democrats to create a special session to come back up to Tallahassee and deal with gun laws following the shooting in Orlando.
Real quick, Gary Finot, I want to ask you, has there been any talk about a special session given the algae blooms, which we spoke about in the first part of this program, and any kind of legislative coordinated response?
No, and I think that it's highly unlikely that you're going to have any of these legislators wanting to come back here between now and when the elections are. Just a reminder, you can't raise money during a session. And so that itself is a powerful motivator to not do anything until after November. You mentioned the algae blooms, and we talked about that earlier. I would tell you that that is possibly going to be an issue that arises in a couple of races. The Elizabeth Beniquisto, who is running in Southwest Florida for the state Senate, she has a Republican opponent who that is one of the main issues that he is going after her on. So, you never know what certain issues are going to arise, and the facts of the day kind of drive the narrative. And that is certainly possible across the state that you have different things, whether it's guns, whether it's the algae blooms in the environment, whether or not, we see some things involving on the immigration debate in the presidential. Yep. These things could all come into play into what happens in the final analysis of the election in November.
Let me add economic development in there, and that's still to come as the Florida Roundup continues. The state agency that's supposed to bring jobs to the Sunshine State is cutting positions itself. So what gives? That's still ahead as our program continues after this. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. For 6 years and two campaigns, Governor Rick Scott has made jobs the central theme of his agenda. But the public-private agency that is the state's primary engine to help drive job growth is shedding jobs itself. Enterprise Florida will cut 26 positions. 12 of those positions are currently vacant. Meantime, some new documents obtained by the Naples Daily News this week show the agency ballooned its executive payroll by $600,000 over 6 years. The salaries for seven executive positions jumped 75%. between 2010 and 2016. All this adding pressure to an agency that's already under increasing scrutiny over spending and performance. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press, Dan Sweeney with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Michael Auslan with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times, Tallahassee Bureau still with us on the roundup. Gary, these job cuts, the result of Governor Scott's failure to secure more incentive money for Enterprise Florida during this past legislative session, yes or no?
Well, that was certainly the response that Governor Scott directed the Enterprise Florida to do. I mean, essentially, when he lost the battle over getting the $250 million he wanted for incentives, he then came back and said, well, if that's not going to be a part of the mission of this entity in the future, then perhaps we should reshape and recalibrate the what we do. Now, so what that resulted in is kind of this interesting decision where Enterprise Florida decided to cut money that it already had authorization to spend. And so that's what they've done is they've gone ahead and said, well, we're going to try to cut up as several million dollars that we're going to try to cut from our budget. We're going to shutter some offices. We're going to lay some people off. It does make for an interesting optic of the idea that the agency responsible for creating jobs is cutting its own jobs.
It's cutting operational budget here, Michael. That's what's interesting. The governor failed in his effort to get more incentive money that essentially would be passed through this agency, not in terms of operating the agency itself, but here it is cutting its own payroll, its own operating budget.
Yeah, it kind of has this feeling of the governor didn't get what he wanted in terms of money for Enterprise Florida, so he took the ball and went home. And this has been a huge signature initiative for Governor Scott, and it was certainly a big hit for him to not get what he was looking for there. But I think it's not entirely clear what all the agency will be able to do moving forward as it reshapes itself. And some of that narrative is still sort of being written as they make these changes, cut back on personnel, close some of their offices.
Dan Sweeney with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, what's the reputation of this agency in the Capitol? Clearly, it was not able to garner enough support for the incentive money. Now that it's cutting its operations, will that satisfy some of its critics in Tallahassee?
There's a kind of a bipartisan push now. I think there will be in the next session to really curb a lot of business incentive money. It's an issue on the left. It's an issue on the right. It's one of the few things that they can find common ground on. The governor and a lot of the legislators, they're just as conservative, but they come at this from a different way. You know, the governor's idea is, hey, give all this money to Enterprise Florida. They'll give it to businesses, which will bring jobs here, sort of a trickle-down economics Reagan-esque kind of thing. In the legislature, you have people saying, we're capitalists. We believe in the free market above all things. And this is picking winners and losers. This is what incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran referred to as corporate welfare. So they're
Dan
both
Sweeney, we've got to leave it there. He's with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, watching politics. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. And Michael Auslan with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times in the capital city. Thank you, gentlemen. Finally, on the roundup this week, Wade is leaving. After 13 years with the Miami Heat, Wade is leaving the only NBA team he has known. He's leaving, like LeBron James did 2 years ago, to return home. In Wade's case, he's headed to the Chicago Bulls, a team he grew up with as a kid in the southern suburbs of that city. Of this city. I'm actually in Chicago today, hosting the Florida Roundup. Chicago is a city where I spent almost 15 years in before moving to South Florida. Like Wade, I know both places well. They're both special places for those of us lucky to have lived and loved them both. Miami is the Magic City. Chicago is the second city. Miami is the only major U.S. city founded by a woman. Chicago made its name as the hog butcher for the world. Miami comes from the Calusa word meaning big water. Chicago, it's a derivative word of an Algonquin language for wild onion. Miami is all about sunshine and ocean breezes. Chicago is the city of big shoulders. Miami has Florida rooms and lanais. Chicago is where the modern skyscraper was born. Miami is bikinis and croquetas. Chicago is mittens and deep dish. Miami is mojitos. Chicago, it's a shot and a beer. Miami is bass and salsa and EDM. In Chicago, it's blues. Chicago reversed the flow of an entire river. In South Florida, we drained almost an entire ecosystem. Miami had Dwayne Wade. We had LeBron James. We still have Chris Bosh. Chicago had Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman. Miami, with Wade, had three trophies. Chicago, with Jordan, had three trophies in a row, twice. Everyone is from someplace. Most of us in South Florida aren't from South Florida, like you, Dwayne. Most of us came for new opportunities, new horizons, new dreams. Some were running away. Some came taking a chance on a new place with an abundance of ambition, but no real blueprint other than spirit and hard work. You can't change where you're from. You can change where you're at and where you're going. Hopefully none of that, though, changes who you are. Dwayne Wade, you are a Heat champion and always will be. All right, that'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Tell us what you're talking about. Join us on social media on Facebook and on Twitter. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. And our technical supervisor today in Miami, Jason Zabka. Thanks, Jay. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.